This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, Split Talkers. We are back after a little bit of a break in the transmission. I am Rob Calder. With me, welcome to country, we have Zoe Carr and Nathan Cooper Brown. Welcome, guys.
Thank you for having us. Very excited to be back.
Yeah, stoked to be back.
Has been a while. There are lots of imitators, always plenty of haters, but it is the original and the best podcast coming out of Wantirna South that is specifically focused on coaching. We are back. It has been a little while. There has been a little bit going on. We will get through a little bit of housekeeping to start off with. Just a reminder, you can follow along on X and Instagram with the @TalkingSplit handle. You can get in touch with Nathan Cooper Brown on X with
@CoachNCB.
You can get Zoe Carr on
@ZoeCarr85.
You can get me @RobCoulter. Of course, if you can leave a rating or a review on iTunes and Spotify, 5 stars only, no sandbagging and throwing out the little 1 stars, 5 stars only, that would be fantastic. So, like I said, there has been a little bit going on since we've been off. Zoe and I are still working through emails from when we went on leave. And apologies.
How dare we?
Apologies to everyone that I still haven't got back to yet. I promise you, your reply is coming at some stage. Coops, you've been travelling the world a touch, it would be fair to say. Do you want to fill us in on your last month or so?
Yeah, very honoured, very excited, very grateful to have travelled to the Middle East, which was an experience within itself, but have come home with the gold medal from the Under-16 Asia Cup. And the staff and the boys were just outstanding and bought into what we were trying to do. Fantastic off the court, understood when to switch on and be a joy to be around, understood when to switch on and really did the green and gold proud and obviously allowed us to get the gold medal. But most importantly, we're now on to Turkey for the Under-17 World Cup next year. So, yeah, it was definitely a positive month.
Without a doubt. Ash Arnott, your assistant coach, talk us through that.
When I let him out of the hotel? Yeah, sure. No, when... Yeah, well, obviously friends of the pod know Ash well, and my relationship with Ash is really strong and close. And when you're in a really high pressure environment, to have somebody that you trust and someone who has your back and knows you, he does a fantastic job of, you know, he can fire me up when I need to get fired up. He can, you know, help calm me down when I need to calm down. So when you have someone like that on your staff, it can be an absolute game changer, and I'm really grateful for the work that he did, and again to be over there with such a good mate to enjoy that experience together was awesome.
I'll ask you both this because you've both been in this position. Obviously, Zoe, you were at the Oceania qualifiers when you were the head coach, and Coop's going through Asia Cup just recently. How do you deal with such wild margins, I suppose, is the best way to put it? So, I mean, Coop's for context for anyone that hasn't gone and had a little bit of a look at it. I don't want to say blowout margins, but fairly extensive score lines all the way through until you hit the final. It's a 3-point game. Like, how do you manage that to get the right sort of feel amongst the group? You can't sit there and say, hey, this is an important game and then win by 50 without the kids looking at you going, hey, is it? Like, it's that kind of thing. Like, how did you manage that?
Yeah, we had a really strong message from the start about how we do anything is how we do everything. So for us, Croc's ball was physical. It was disciplined. And it was unselfish. So we talked about Croc's ball, you know, that was an ongoing theme. And we also spoke about, this was a balancing act, but we did speak about, you know, that we kind of had bigger fish to fry, you know, not trying to put the cart before the horse and get too far ahead of ourselves. But the idea was that, you know, this is a 2-year plan that, you know, that we're trying to build to something. And you know, beating Sri Lanka by 110 points, you know, the outcome is meaningless if the process isn't right. And we worked quite hard behind the scenes. Obviously, we only had our selection camp really, you know, to get together. So we had Zoom meetings. We had our WhatsApp group. Like, we were really driving that message from, you know, from months ago that we are, that we're trying to achieve something special. And it wasn't about a pool game. It was more about the process, about the habits, and the guys were fantastic in that, and obviously it showed that, you know, we could go from an average winning, you know, margin, I think it was like 68 points or something like that, to still grind out a 3-point win against a generational New Zealand team. Like, that team's really, really good. Like, they'll have a good World Cup, and and was a credit to our guys to get over the line in that one.
Yep. How about you, Zoe? I mean, you went through it as well. What was it like on your end?
Yeah, it was tough because you're trying to hold to a standard and, you know, we're, I suppose, lucky enough, I guess you could call it, to not have the three-point grind-out game at all through our rounds or through finals. So it did have to become that once it was set that we'd qualified and we were on to Asia Cup, that now we've got one eye here and one eye on what's next. And, you know, so we started talking about how our position discipline defensively and all those sort of things that are really important once you get to Asia, the ability to keep the ball in front, no straight line drives. Like, so we tweaked what we were statting as well to try and help us with that, straight line drives being a really big one, because it's sort of one of the things that when the foot comes off the gas a little bit, that goes out the door, because it's like, oh, well, we'll get the ball back and we'll score again and we'll be okay. And it's like, well, no, you're okay here, but at the next one, if that's Japan or that's China or even Chinese Taipei, now all of a sudden that becomes a problem. So it was about trying to still, we had a job to do in Guam, and we weren't going to, I guess, look away from or not give the credit that the teams that were there deserved. And, you know, same amount of scout, same amount of prep, all of that went into it. But it was also reminding and important to remind them that they're in a lucky position to be in this tournament. It's another opportunity to be seen for Asia Cup, for World Cup. And everyone that needs to be watching is watching, and rarely do people forget. So what sort of a impression do you want to leave on, you know, whoever's taking the job next and, you know, and going off to or is in charge of selecting or not selecting you? So it was just trying to, yeah, move the goalposts a little bit, but not too far that they forgot about what was in front of them.
How did you go, Coops? It's been a while since you coached a game, obviously, and then you roll into the tournament and it's like, you remember to take a whiteboard to Texas and those types of things. Like, is it different jumping back into that, because even you haven't done it for a little while?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. You know, there's nothing like the experience of game coaching and being able to get those reps and, you know, set yourself up for success that way. You know, I tried a number of things back here to generate some extra game reps. I was really lucky. I was able to coach some games in our Giddy Daniels Cup. We played against a university team from Chinese Taipei. So, again, I was able to head coach that group. So I was trying to manufacture a few things, but obviously, there's nothing like international basketball and actually head coaching. So, again, the preparation part is key. That's always been an important part of the way that I coach anyway. So, you know, watching extra film, you know, my coach strategy card, going through my mental processes, you know, both on the sideline, in the locker room, to make sure that my mind was as switched on as possible. But, yeah, there was still some moments of, yeah, okay, I've got to remember this or I've got to remember that. But it was nice to, from what I felt, get better as the tournament went on, and hopefully I can carry that through to Worlds.
Super work, and all the best, obviously, for that. When's the next camp looking like?
It won't be till after under 18 nationals.
Big leader.
Yeah, next year, yeah.
But you got some coaching to do before then. You got an under 20s tournament you'll be involved with. So what we're talking today, obviously we all live in this sort of space of coach development in particular, and I think everyone makes themselves fairly accessible to coaches that are looking for more information and all that sort of stuff. Now, because of that, we don't have many weekends, it would be fair to say, where there's nothing on, but those rare weekends where we do, we end up presenting coaching courses, which is great fun, really rewarding, all that sort of stuff. No issues with that at all. But we do tend to get a lot of the same questions asked at these coaching courses. And it doesn't matter what age group, where, all that sort of stuff, we tend to get the same questions. So we're going to try and knock out a few of them now and just get some different perspectives on this. So we've gone the top 10. feel like I'm Letterman doing like a little top 10 list that I can throw a little card at someone. Zoe's looking at me like I'm too young for this conversation. Coops is like,
I know what you're talking about.
Coops is like, yeah, I've been up at 1:30 a.m. too watching that. And then all of a sudden it was like, you know, Backstreet's Back came on afterwards with the video hits. And, you know, we've all been there. I get it.
Yeah. Was that like before or after Hot Dogs Up Late game show?
It was usually slightly before, which shows you exactly how late that game show was going. But the number one question I get asked at every coaching course I go to, how do I get my players to box out and rebound the ball? What do you got, Coops?
If it's important to you, it's important to them. So if you are taking time to value rebounding and proving to your athletes that it is important, it's important to what you're trying to do in terms of develop them as individuals and obviously have team success, that's going to be a better platform to start from. Put it into context, one of the things that we talk about heavily, and I think I've mentioned on the pod before, but we talk a lot about the free point battle. So like internationally, we know that the free point battle is something big for us. We talk about it at country Vic level because we are, you know, one of the minnow states, if we think, you know, when we're comparing ourselves to some of the bigger programs. And part of that is second chance points. So there's an ongoing narrative around controlling the free point battle, controlling second chance points, and that has to come through rebounding. The technique part is important. So understanding how to teach the new way of rebounding, forearm to the chest, create a T, chin on inside shoulder, rather than the old Joy Burke radar butt, which I always like using. So if a player turns and tries to use their backside to find the box out too early, usually that's a flyby tip dunk. So, you know, taking time to talk about the right technique. And then something again that hopefully this translates, we start a lot of our actions in circle the wagon rebounding. So if we're doing an up and back or some three trip or something, we will start that action with circle the wagon rebounding. So yes, the focus may be on offensive transition or defensive transition or our secondary motion, whatever it may be, but we are starting that first 8 seconds of the possession in a box out scenario. For anyone that doesn't know, so we put five players on the outside on the perimeter, put five players on the inside. We say go. Those players on the inside are running around like circle the wagons back in the old Western times, and they need to point and communicate to who is their box out as they pass them. So obviously it's getting some point and talk into it, and then a coach will pass to one of the perimeter athletes. They'll shoot the ball, and then it's body first, ball second. So we're actually getting a hit of rebounding, and then we'll move into the next possession. So if you're valuing it, if you're talking about it, if you're teaching it, and if you're finding ways to work on it, it's definitely going to help you.
Yep. What about you, Zoe? Anything else?
Well, I mean, Coops has hit the nail right on the head, but I think one of the things that we don't do from an offensive rebounding perspective is play things out, repeated efforts. Mm, so, yeah. You know, we want to make sure everything is to a stop or a score, and those sort of things will generally start to help you learn to how to read the flight of the ball, out of the hand, but two also off the rim, which is a really underrated skill.
And Dennis Rodman in
The Last
Jordan
Dance.
Ducker, yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
But it is, and he's right. Like, it's and it's not something – I don't think it's something you can actually teach. I think it's something that comes –
This is the great debate. Are good rebounders born or are they made?
No, I don't think they're – I don't think they're born, but I don't think they're taught either. Yep. I think what it comes from is pick up and play and playing against bigger, faster, stronger and all those sort of things.
Will.
So you got to figure it out and you've got to find new ways. I don't think it's a coach actually standing there saying, you know what you need to do? You need to count the amount of revolutions of the backspin of the ball, and that will mean it'll – you know, I don't think it's any of that.
Good
I think
luck
it's,
with a little nine-year-old working out what a
exactly.
revolution is for a start.
That's what I mean. Like, it's, I think it comes from genuine gameplay and genuine, I guess, win/loss on every possession, and gets you into that habit. And as Coop said, the biggest one is valuing it. If you value it, then they will too. And consistency with that messaging.
Yep.
So if you're going to, it tends to happen a bit on the defensive side when you miss box outs, you know, you have a possession, you miss a box out, you highlight it, or you know, you put a penalty in or you do whatever it is, and then in two possessions time you miss another box out, and sometimes you're, oh God, like, again, and you sort of let it fly. As soon as you let it fly, that's it. It means you don't value it. So consistency in your messaging becomes crucial. And a big one that I've got from Coops on that is, like, if you are going to put a penalty in, don't put them on a baseline and make them run. Like, make the skill the penalty. So make them box out somehow. Make them have to, you know, sit up against a wall to help with that core strength or that you know, glute and hamstring, quad strength, so they can be better next time, and those sort of thing. Make the skill the penalty.
Yeah, and even just adding in extra points for a rebound in your scrimmages is a great way of just getting them to sort of hunt that a little bit more. And sometimes you can go down the path of, hey, the team gets the extra point. Sometimes you go down the path of, nah, screw it, every person for themselves, and go work it out and just have them almost fight for each other. I'm sure we've all done, like, the hamburger drill, the war drill, and those types of things at our training sessions.
PTSD, like, from college right now, Robbie. The hamburger drill. Jeez.
Yeah, that's no good.
But you look at it too, and if you're lucky enough to have enough coaches at your session to put someone on it, you can put someone over the course of your session to stat your session, and, you know, extra point for offensive rebound, minus point for turnover or poor decision, or, you know, that sort of stuff. And you start to get a sense of, there are athletes that sort of fly through and you think, yeah, they're not doing anything right, but they're not doing anything wrong. And then you do those sort of, you know, experiments, if you want to call it that, and you start to see just how efficient they are, and, you know, the extra points that they create for the team, not necessarily themselves, and, you know, when they're on the floor, turnovers are way down, and, you know, all those sort of things. So if you're lucky enough, I'd recommend it, and that can then be the data you use to highlight your rebounding, whether good or bad, and work on it from there.
The hard part, obviously, is if you're like a little under 12s team, you obviously 100%. Don't have access to that, and stats that's don't really mean a whole lot to them. Like,
yeah, if you're lucky enough to have that in your coaching in the older age groups.
So the next question, should I give players equal court time?
What are we coaching here?
Let's say domestic to start off with, and then we'll
100%,
build from there.
Yes, domestic, yep. There's no excuse. All kids need to play. Domestic is supposed to be the vehicle into the sport and where they learn to love the sport. So, yes, I 100% believe in domestic. All kids should get equal court time. Now, you can manufacture that to make sure that the kids you want on at the end of the game are on at the end of the game. And sometimes the trick to that is actually not starting one of those players and having somebody else start. But, yeah, I don't think – and similar to Friday nights, particularly in 12s and 14s, I think in those age groups I don't think there's any reason for kids to not play. You know, when you start to get up to 16s and 18s in your, you know, your top teams and your VC teams, and you're having to learn how to win, and you're having to learn how to, you know, sort of drive people to work harder to get better, and all those sort of things, well then – you know, I think different things come into play there, but those other age groups, you know, how are they going to learn to love it? How are they going to learn to get any better at it if they're sitting and watching?
So how do you manage it then, Coops, in a situation where a player potentially
Coops might not agree.
No, you will. He'll agree. I'm confident of that. Where a player potentially hasn't turned up to practice for like 3 weeks in a row and you're an equal court time coach, like at what stage do you sort of bend? Like, is that something you've experienced?
Oh, it starts with the relationship with the athlete, starts with the relationship with the family. You know, often young coaches, and I did this, you know, your first reaction is obviously they don't care. They don't care about basketball. They don't respect me as a coach. I'm going to bench them instead of having the conversation. Which I do now is, you know, somebody misses or I haven't heard from someone, the first text message or question is, are you okay? You know, what's happening? Are you okay? You know, do you need to talk about it? So just finding out why. And so obviously, and now there's a series of caveats that come from that. Okay, maybe one was because the athlete, two were because of a parent. Okay, maybe we've got a one get out of jail free card because it's under 14s and, you know, we're trying to build habits, but we're also not trying to, again, destroy the love of the game, which I think Zoe's right on the money there. Like that's our obligation as coaches. I don't care what the level is that we continue to make this thing fun. If it's all parents, that one's probably pretty easy, but may need a follow-up conversation with the parent. Hey, you know, missed last few practice or late to practice, you know, everything okay? Can we help maybe organize a lift with another family? So on and so forth. Obviously, they can have those discussions. If it's the athlete and they've basically kind of snubbing their nose, they've missed the last three practices and they're still prepared to play, again, now we're having another conversation around, you know, do you really want to be here? You know, is this what you want? You know, can you maybe curtail their behavior through staggering some court time? You know, do they need to miss a game to get their head on straight? So there's obviously lots of different things that you can do there. But I think especially now in this new era of information and responsibility and maturity of young people and question asking of young people and mental health and those sorts of things that really probably weren't taken into account back in our day. Mm-hmm. The more conversations we're having in those areas, the better, and it can't just be black and white around court time.
Yep. And I think it's really important too that and I think you've said it on the pod before, Rob, you've got to set what your rules are early as well regarding those sort of things like practice and stuff like that, because you know, there's more and more multi-sport athletes. Now, if an athlete's missing a training because they have a game for another sport, if you've said that's okay at the start of the year, then that's okay at the end of the year. Like, it's, again, that consistency and that messaging. But that's got to be something that's then laid out to everybody. So everyone's going in with open eyes, and it's not, you know, oh, you said one thing and did another, or we didn't know, or any of that. And that sort of helps you, I guess, negate those sort of problems as well, because then they know it's a priority for you. And so then if they are missing for whatever reason, they're probably more likely to come and talk to you about it because you've set those ground rules from the start.
Absolutely. All right, next question. I've got a player that won't pass. What do I do? Yeah. Just for the ease of information.
Was this your question?
We'll call this person Darren. Coops, what would you do in this situation?
No, that's too obvious.
Yeah.
Miss the best.
Yeah. And we're back. Yeah, interesting one. Would want to know a little bit more about the player. One of my favorite quotes is, it's easier to calm down a fool than it is to resurrect a dead man. So if this player is playing at an aggressive way and kind of trying to do the right thing but maybe overdoing it, obviously our best teacher is film. You know, we can sit, you know, film a game, sit down. Hey, love this downhill attack. You got 2 feet in the paint. How many defenders do you see? I see 3. What does that mean? Somebody's open. Okay, maybe we can start looking at driving to score and, you know, one-on-one. You know, one-on-none, have some fun, one-on-none. One-on-one, get it done. One-on-two, not for you. Start having some fun with our rhymes. If it's an issue of maybe they can't pass, so, you know, that the skill of passing is kind of fallen behind, then obviously we've got to put together a plan around creating that skill base so they feel more comfortable passing the ball, probably especially under pressure. You know, they get into a crowd, not sure how to get rid of it, so they shoot it instead. So, okay, maybe going that little bit deeper and be like, okay, what's their passing ability like? And then, you know, if you've got that instance where it's really more of a genuine selfish attitude, you know, then there's, again, probably some more digging to be done around, you know, where is that coming from? Is that coming from a car ride home from a parent that's saying, hey, if, you know, if you don't shoot it every time you get it, you know, we're not going to Macca's or something
like
that. Or
I'll pay you $1 for every score.
$1 for every score? Damn. Like inflation. It's gone up significantly since I was a junior.
How much were you paid per score?
About 5 cents. And my parents did not go broke, like I can assure you.
Yeah, so, you know, and unfortunately, as we know, you know, the number one reason kids leave sport early is because of the car ride home, and which is sad, and that those sorts of things are happening. So, again, relationships, connection, You know, is that sort of thing happening? What are some strategies we could put together to maybe offset that? Is it a talk with the parent? Is it, you know, taking some stats for the team, but only taking, you know, positive stats like assists and box outs and charges and things like that. So then again, the positive impact that the athlete is having can be translated to the parent, who's obviously competitive with themselves, which is not always the worst thing, but in another way rather than just scoring points.
Yep. So in a world where we potentially don't have film, then Zoe, how important is recreating a situation that you've seen in the game at a training session so that they can like almost talk you through what they're seeing, I suppose?
Yeah, that was going to be my suggestion, is as many decision-making drills as possible and then being able to explain the why. And I genuinely believe the amount of athletes that are hogging the ball, for want of a better term, is not coming from a selfish place. It's coming from self-preservation, for one, because while they've got the ball, they believe it's safe. You know, having to make a pass is scary. Like, it's frightening for some kids.
Ball out of your hands.
Ball out of hands. It's in the air. That's where it's up for grabs. So if I've got it and I'm still dribbling it, well then, you know, I'm less of a chance of losing it. It's a backwards way of thinking, but you can also understand how they get there. Yeah, putting them in as many decision-making drills as possible. And even if you're just shooting the ball, put a decision in there somewhere. You know, yeah, whether whether it be like, you know, you've got a secondary receiver and the passer can defend you or defend the receiver, and that decision's got to come of whether you shoot it or whether you extra. You're getting your shots up. You're still working on the skill of shooting the ball. But now I've always got to be thinking about something. And then you can, you know, if you have to go that next step, that's again a conversation with the parents or with a family. And even just asking them to, you know, step when you are doing those drills on the floor in practice, asking them to step on the floor and film it from their phone, so you're not having to worry about, you know, any sort of child safety issues or anything like that. Get them to film it. So then they've also got it. So they've got your instruction and what you want. They've got when it's worked, when it hasn't worked, all that sort of stuff that then the athlete can go away and watch in their own time too. And it also helps curb if it is a parental influence that is causing that sort of stuff to happen. Then it gets the parents educated too as to what you want from your team and from that athlete.
The nicest possible way of saying some parents are crazy.
Well, I mean, that's a pod in itself, isn't it?
Just to build on that, because I think that's spot on. I think the more decision-making stuff we're doing, the better, especially younger, is just going to help build better basketballers. And then I think when you're doing that, you know, you need to be asking, what did you see? You know, so you know, try as often as possible, ask, what did you see? And then the other one is, what's most important? You know, what's most important? Yeah. What did you see?
And I think what's really important when you ask that question, what did you see? There's no wrong answer there.
I disagree.
So no.
The 2 feet in front of my my feet.
What
is
I
the
mean
wrong
is,
answer.
When I say no wrong answer, they don't get chewed out for any of their answers. I think, you know, I often ask a question of, did you see so and so in the corner? And they say no. And it's like, right, so that's got to be in your line of vision. That position on the floor has to be in your line of vision. So how do you change it? And they're like, oh, I need to scan, or I need to, you know, be more aware of my receiver spots or whatever it might be, which is great. That's great learning. But if I say, did you see so-and-so in the corner? And they say no, and then I rip them because they didn't see someone in the corner. Well, now they're just going to lie to me, and they're just going to say yes, and they'll probably get themselves in more trouble. So I think when we're talking decision making, we have to be patient. Like, I think we can get a little too caught up, and we want decision making doesn't evolve the same way ball handling can evolve. You know, you can sit at home and do your ball handling drills and do your ball handling drills in practice, and you will see marked improvement probably from week to week. Decision making is not the same. It'll just, you'll feel like you're getting nowhere and you're running in mud, and then all of a sudden something will click and you'll just get that little glimmer of light, and then it might even go away for a while. But again, it comes back to consistency of our messaging. When you do see that glimmer, you have to champion that, whether it works or doesn't work. If the decision was right and the idea is right, you have to champion that like nobody's business. Because otherwise, if you, one, miss it, or two, sort of just go, oh, yeah, good one, or, you know, then the athlete's probably not going to do it again. Like, you've got to create that environment that, hey, you know, like that story you tell of the little fella that threw the ball behind his head pass. Right decision. Now, execution was poor, but you're under 12s. But the decision and the thought process was fantastic. And so you don't champion that and you never get it again. And so we then don't see that sort of improvement. So I'd caution on decision-making, things like that. Just stay patient and champion the idea.
Yeah, okay. So the next question is, why shouldn't I do three-player weaves at practice?
It's no decision.
Yeah, that's the perfect leading, in all honesty. You know, like, what, it's though? Not a repeatable skill into a game.
Yeah.
Like, so no. It makes perfect sense. Like, the best drills involve really – like it's the three R's. Like, I think it's like repetition, realism, and relevance. Like, real, yes, three-player weaves are repetitive, no question. Is it repetitive that would transfer into a game situation? Not really. Like, is it a realistic thing that you would see in a game? I've never seen a team throw the ball then run behind it to get there. Like, there's some funky press breakers out there, but that's not one of them. And is it relevant to what you do? Not really. Like, if you're doing it to, like, turn your legs over before a training, so, like, I'd probably get it for a senior team or something like that. Like, hey, get up and down a couple of times just to get some movement in. But I feel like there are better ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard though, right? Like, you only know what you know. And I think three-man weave or three-player weave is something that's, I think, used between, you know, netball in particular as well. I think they do a bit of that too. I think the intent of that drill is right. You're trying to get movement. You're trying to get passing on the move. You're trying to get the ball through lots of people's hands and get up and down and all that sort of stuff. It's just, yeah, the execution of it, like you said, it's not really relevant to gameplay. You're better off, you know, having – even if you're gonna, if you want to do three player weave, that's fine. Throw a couple defenders in, or something like that, just to make it that little bit more difficult. The ability to dribble, you know, all those sort of things that you can throw in just to make it a little bit more gameplay. But as my colleague sitting across from me often says, any drill with no decision is a waste. So
well, this is the hard part though, because I saw the LA Clippers the other day doing three player weaves as a warm up. It's like, well, here's the hard part. We're trying to tell players and coaches not to do this, but NBA teams still do it. And to be fair, they were doing it as a warm-up. Like, it was to get up and down.
Cue Coop's rant.
we need a harder sound effect. Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
I'll work on something for you there.
Do you know what? I mean, not to get too ranty, but I think that's where we are starting to separate ourselves as a basketball nation. And it's a credit to the people that are being innovative, that have a growth mindset, that want to try and do things a different way and improve on what we're doing. A lot of that American-based coaching comes from such a singular pathway of hearing one voice for potentially 5, 10, 15 years. So if the dinosaur head coach at their college, all he did was three-man weaves, and they were a grad assistant, third assistant, second assistant, first assistant, when they get their head coaching job, you can guarantee they are going to do three-man weaves. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if that coach in that session, even with an NBA team, was coming from that base.
Yeah, quite possible. And look, to be fair to a lot of people out there that are coaching, in particular sort of those domestic levels, they probably played as a junior where that was a drill that was used a fair bit. And so consequently, they come back in, they do what they know, which is 100%. Three-player weaves. Now, if you're in a position where you know three-player weaves, you're comfortable with that, but you're hearing this and you're thinking, hey, I'd like to step out of that three-player weave shadow that you've been talking about, hit me up and I will send you some content that you can use instead of three-player weaves. I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm saying they're wrong. They're wrong, they're bad, they are the worst drill in the world. You should not. No, it's not the case. But if you are looking for some different content, shoot me an email, rob.colderatebasketballvictoria.com.au. It takes me about 4 weeks to get back to you, but I will come back to you, especially at the moment, but I will come back to you with some other content that you can use at training sessions, because there is better stuff out there that does incorporate decision making, that does incorporate some more realistic game movements.
Well, just one last thing on it, Rob, just so we're not beating the three-man weave horse to death.
Beat away.
Like, if you're just thinking about our, you know, offense is spacing, spacing is offense. And when is really the only time we actually bring an offensive player together with another offensive player? Usually if to cause some sort of, handoff, screen, something to create an advantage. But if we're in transition and we're bringing two players together, we're immediately losing our spacing and we're allowing more defenders to load up onto the ball. So we're actually losing the thing that we're trying to create in the full court. So just if we wanted to get a little bit more nerdy on it, there's some extra info.
Even if you're looking for something for just warm up and turn legs over, just 5-on-0 your transition running rules, you know, hitting your sideline, hit the tees, own the corners, bounce back, all that sort of stuff. And just, you don't have to do anything special. That turns your legs over, if you're lucky enough to have a full court. That turns your legs over, gets you sort of into it, gets you from, you know, probably static warm up to movement. And then you can get into your session and it's reiterating your rules of where you need to run and those sort of things. So there are other things out there, and but yeah, I think and I know whilst we're all joking, I think we need to also make sure we're not smashing certain drills or people for running them, because you only know what you know. So I'd really encourage people to, if you're not sure, contact Rob and get that content, because it can be really helpful, and you actually see a really big change in your session too. You know, I used to do three player weave into 2-on-1 and 5 into 3-on-2. I used to do that.
To be clear, I'm cool with that. Like, if you want to go like three player weave into 2-on, no issue at all whatsoever. I'm saying like the legitimate
just straight
three
up. Player. Yeah, waves.
Yeah, like no good to me. Like that's yeah. But it's a preference thing. But yeah, if you incorporate decision making on the way back, no issue.
But when you start to see this other content that you'll be able to provide, you actually see a different lift in your session. You know, your session starts off on the right foot, you know, they're up and about, you know, it's all that sort of stuff, and you can see them start to enjoy it. And as Coop said, that's what we want. We want joy in our sessions and kids learning to love the game.
Story time, Rob.
Ooh, oh, times two.
Yeah, well, here we go.
Boom.
No, this first one doesn't really count.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that really needed like air sirens and
yeah.
Definitely. When I was in college, we would start our offensive practice day. So one day we would have a defensive focus. Next we'd do an offensive focus.
Just out of curiosity, what was the attendance like at the defensive sessions?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I always had class that day.
Yeah, funny.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so exactly, you can guess the mindset of the athletes. But we would start our offensive day. So we would do our warm-up and then we would start with Cincinnati layups.
Yeah, it's a throwback.
And we had to get,
that is a throwback.
And we had to get 20 in a row. And if we didn't get 20 in a row, we did it again and we did it again. And how do you think like our mindset was starting a practice? Like, it started out in fear. Yeah. It started out like with so much cortisol, like screaming through our body, so tight through the traps because you just didn't want to miss a layup that it just.
But what did, and going off topic a little bit here, what that does though is cause you to slow down on the layup.
Correct.
It's now no longer game relevant.
Correct.
You're now, as you said, playing in fear.
Yep.
If you just flip that, you could probably do the same drill. Now, again, not a drill for me, but that's okay. You could do that where it's like, hey, you got to make 20 in a minute 10. And all of a sudden, the tempo goes up. It's now more relevant to a game situation. Yeah. And that's the thing. You can use the drill, but use it for good rather than fear.
Yeah. I mean, I'd even start out, say, we've just got to attempt 20 in a minute.
Yeah.
Now absolutely. We're zipping. Mm. Now we can refine it. Okay, now we're making 10 in a minute. Or, you know, put a defender in. You know, and now there's a decision like we were talking about. But just that idea of on-air, target-based stuff that's not game relevant and just doesn't help athletes enjoy what they're doing or get better.
Yep.
What was the longest it took you to get it?
It took us
4 weeks.
He's still going. Actually, his teammates are still going.
Yeah. No, one day it was getting away from us. I reckon we were pushing the 10-minute mark, and it was bad too because it was like the 19th, like three times in a row. And finally coach gave up and did did his old reliable and just put us on the line for a 17 in a minute.
Excellent.
Oh,
which he would usually finish every session with.
Excellent.
Oh, well, fun times. Speaking of.
That's a pod in itself. Yeah, it really college is. Experience. Yeah.
it really would be.
What do I do when my players can't reach the ring when they're shooting? This is one I get a lot with like the coaches that have put their hand up to coach little babies, the 8s and 10s that just physically cannot reach the ring. What are you doing, Coops?
Wow, tough question. Yeah, it's so hard because you want the kid or the athlete, the child, you want them to experience success. You want to see them make a shot, and there's nothing like a young kid, you know, making a shot in the game and, you know, you're seeing their face light up. But obviously, as we know, the main kind of criminal in creating poor shot technique is trying to shoot, you know, threes when you're too young, and that's where all the bad stuff comes from. And so I think it's a balancing act. I think if there's a world in which you can help the child understand when it's okay to shoot the two-handed shot and be able to make it maybe more of a layup, maybe something, you know, maybe kind of close in so that they're going to see that. But everywhere else is our one-shot practice, and everything's process-driven. Everything's process-driven. You know, it's take the basket away. You know, take some photos, take some film. Oh, my God, look how amazing your shot looks. What a beautiful follow-through. Oh, the balance hand was side on. This is looking so great. But then if they make a two-hand layup in a game and their face lights up, yeah, it's like, great. Oh, yeah, nice shot. Oh, I love that you got to score. That was awesome. Really excited to get back to work this week on a one-handed shot. So it's a really tough spot in balancing, again, the joy of the game and wanting to see the kids do well and have success, but still trying to build them for something that, you know, for later on that they're obviously striving for.
What are your thoughts?
I would first question in those younger age groups whether the association has implemented the size 5.
Yep, and the 8-footer.
And the 8-foot rim, if possible. And if they haven't implemented the size 5, I'd be a strong push because we've seen the difference it's making in that exact, you know, because otherwise, you know, practice, it's – you know, the way you need to shoot. So it doesn't matter if make or miss, you know, all that sort of stuff. Once you get to a game, though, you have to let them off the chain. Yeah. Like, let them go. Yeah. Let them have fun. And just remind them. Like, you know, one of the ones I found really difficult when coaching sort of that under 10s, under 12s age group was, like, two-step layups rather than coming to a stop because they feel like they need to come to that jump stop to be able to make their layup. And in the game, I don't care what you do. Do whatever a chance to get you to get a score or touch the rim or, you know, all that sort of stuff. But once they come to their 2-foot stop, it's like, hey, good job. Remember, we want to try and go 1-2, you know, up. And they go, yep, they're not listening, but it doesn't matter. But it's just that exposure and that reminder that, you know, this is where we want to get to. It's okay that you're not there now, but this is where we want to get to. And then once you're in practice, now you're back to the way I want it with and again, because, you know, wins and loss isn't on the line. You know, they want to, like you said, Coops, they want a chance to just make a bucket. So give it to them. And,
to be honest, I love those associations that have all the kids take a foul shot at halftime.
I love
just
that
so
too.
Just so they at least get a crack at it. Like, cool. It adds to the score, which is fine. But, I really like that because there might be one random kid that just doesn't touch the ball. Like we've seen what 5-on-5 look like in under 8s and under 10s. Like it's just chaos. It's
especially
like
when there's
like
10
wherever
and a
the
team.
Ball is that's beast of the honeypot. Like it's a nightmare. So give them a chance. I'm all for it.
That's why I know I've said it before. I'll say it again. Like domestic committees, competitions, please consider just going to 3-on-3 for under 8s and under 10s. Yep. A kid should never get in the car after a basketball game, never having touched the ball. Mm. Yep. Like, you want to see him walk off to another sport? That's how we do it.
Yep, absolutely. We're going to combine two questions into one here because it's time poor on my end. Is it okay to play zone? And if I'm not allowed to play zone, how is it any different to a press? Zoe, you can take this one.
Okay, well, depends on your age group. if you're playing, if you're
Coops and I have just kicked back on the Sunlanders this year and we're just waiting.
Depends on your age group. If you're in 12s and 14s, I don't believe it's okay to play a zone. I think if you value accountability on the ball defensively from your team, if you value development, if you value the work that you should be putting into their shot as well, you shouldn't want to see a zone, because especially in that 14s when they start to go up a size with their basketball, you know, the shots that you can only get are well outside their range yet, you know. So for me, from a development perspective, no, you shouldn't be playing a zone in those younger age groups, and would fight that. Older age groups, yes, I think you should. I think because, you know.
For how long though?
That was going to be my next thing, is we've got to get out of I'm just going to sit in a zone.
If you've got five kids or something like that.
Of course.
Self-preservation does come into this.
Yeah. Absolutely. But if you've got subs to burn, and especially if you're someone that struggles to get your subs through, full court matchup the whole time. Your kids will exhaust themselves if they're doing it properly, and that'll make your subs easier and it'll get everyone feeling like they've contributed to the game. But, yeah, I think it needs to be used as a change-up rather than and I say the same thing about a press as well. Use it sparingly. Don't just sit in it for 40 minutes or 32 minutes or even just a – you know, we often see the first quarter doesn't quite go to plan, so then the next three quarters we're just going to sit in a zone. There needs to be a thought of how do we get better at this? We're clearly not where we need to be because, you know, we're down or whatever it is. How do we get better at this so we can just throw a zone on for a, you know, a two-minute change up momentum, change the geography of their offense, change all of that, and then pull them back out and just keep, like, play that chess game. That's what's fun about coaching, that chess game. Nobody, I don't think, has ever been successful in a chess game where they've put a pawn forward in their first move and then just sat there for the rest of the game.
Well, if they like, play me, they're a reasonable chance to win.
But it just doesn't work. So
how's it any different to a press then?
So then, again, I would have the same argument for sitting in a press for a whole game. The difference, I guess, with a press is that especially now in the younger age groups with the size five, there is an ability to pass through that press now because the ball's lighter and, you know, you're not needing two hands and all those sort of things. The handle of the ball is better so they can catch and go and avoid the trap before. And I've from seeing the implementation through the VJBL, I'm seeing more of that, which is good. But I also completely disagree with sitting in a zone, press just as much as I do sitting in a zone, mainly because the poor kid at the back, like the, because it's always an arrow press, 1-2-1-1, and that last one barely plays the game. If you've got,
I take four steps forward. Yeah. Oh, we scored. I'll take four steps back. Oh, yeah, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
And obviously there are opportunities to break it. And you know, when we were putting the zone ban in, you know, a lot of it was, we'll teach them how to beat it. Okay, but in those age groups, that's not what we should be putting our time into. Our time should be going into, you know, shot technique, ability to pass and catch, ability to dribble, you know, all those sort of things. Our time shouldn't be in 12s and 14s, dedicated to offense, like, you know, how to break this press and how to break this zone. And again, on the other side of it, if we're going to talk the defensive side of the ball, look how we defend the ball across the board, like on the ball. It is terrible. So the ability to be accountable on the ball and not just, oh, well, someone behind me will get it. Like, no, you keep the ball in front of you. And if you can't, again, that's where you have that review. That's where you get back to practice and work on those things. That's what development is. It's not just, you know, obviously when you get up to senior teams and all that sort of stuff and, you know, wins and losses matter and cost jobs and contracts and all that sort of stuff, well, then, yeah, you kind of got to play into deficiencies, I guess. But
if they coach the right way in juniors, there will be no deficiencies.
Correct. There'll always be deficiencies, yeah, but
certainly less. You know, they've experienced that.
Yeah, we've got to give our job is to give them a chance, and playing into deficiencies is not giving our athletes a chance.
Well, there you go.
I needed the rant button. Sorry about that.
Yes. Zoe's just gone full Billy Madison. And just like wiped
I need to
out.
Take my jumper off.
Coops, do you even want to add anything to that?
Yeah, at the end of the day, do you care more about your athletes or do you care more about winning?
Ding.
I mean, he just said everything I said in like six words. But it is something that means a lot to me, obviously, yep, with the zone ban and all that sort of stuff. So, and the size 5 basketball. So it is, yeah, if you want to continue the conversation, I'm happy to have it.
Coops, next question. How do I get my players to play harder? They're a little bit timid during the game. How do I get them to play harder?
Yeah, another hard one, because as we know, there's certain level of competitiveness and a willingness to embrace contact that is a little bit ingrained that you can see in athletes. Again, I come back to the same points earlier about, you know, if it's important to us, it's important to them, and you know, you've got to create an environment of toughness. You've got to create an environment of competitiveness and hardness. So. You know, what are you valuing? So if a player does dive on a loose ball, is there any celebration compared to when a player shoots a three? You know, obviously it's sending two different messages. So straight away, you kind of got to take a step back and say, okay, well, what's the environment I've created here? What are we celebrating? What are we emphasizing? So that would be the first part. Can you start adding some ignition drills or toughness drills, or some different ways to, again, maybe start a normal drill that you like, so maybe a shell drill. Can you start that with a dive for a loose ball? You know, so it's you'd run out to half court, roll the ball on the floor. Athlete's got to do a penguin dive, you know, so they get used
a
to understanding.
Penguin dive? I've never heard that before.
We were the penguins in college.
Oh, gotcha.
So hence the floor burns.
Coops' eye just twitched six times.
Yeah. A lot of caffeine today, Coops.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe that. You know, so maybe you roll it out. They sprint out, dive, get the ball, stand up, throw it back to the coach. Now the coach throws it in and you're in a 4v3 shell. So now the defense has to do a good job of, you know, guarding four players for that, you know, 2 or 3 seconds that the player is recovering. So you're in that advantage disadvantage scenario. Now the player comes in, they've got to talk themselves into it. So you've added a little bit of toughness with the just getting used to feeling what it is like to be on the deck and hit the floor and understand how to fall properly, and then sprint back in. So level of toughness, what's next mentality. The other guys have got a level of toughness around, okay, we've got to play that little bit harder because we're a man down. So I think just continuing to manufacture your environment, celebrate the things that you want, and if you are and you can, try and recruit a couple of tough nuts every now and then as well.
Yeah, Zoe, I know you've had this problem. When I say problem, like it's something you've been trying to address with your country girls in particular. How have you gone about just creating a little bit more? I hate to use the word toughness because it is a little bit of a sort of throwaway term, I suppose. But how have you gone about trying to have them combat that?
Yeah, so we don't shy away from it. We talk about it and bring up about how if you want to be an athlete, a basketballer, you've got to be able to take and give contact and be okay with it. And you've got to be able to match physicality and be an imposing presence. But that also starts from what I've noticed with the athletes I'm working with, not just about the actual sort of physicality act of like putting them in a drill and making them, you know, making everything competitive, like we mentioned before, stop, score, playing things out. So if you're playing like 1v1, for example, if it's a score or a stop, it transitions to the half court at least. So there's that sort of, you know, those sort of things. You can do all of that. It's actually a mindset shift that I've noticed with the girls that I'm working with and allowing them to feel comfortable to be strong and be comfortable sort of throwing their weight around a little bit and having a presence and you know, owning their environment and sort of saying, hey, I'm here. And that once their mind starts to shift, everything else seems to sort of come with it. The thing I would do if I was in a team environment, though, and I learnt this from one of my athletes, would be if it was just the, everything I was doing wasn't working, I'd actually look to cross, use a different sport, and I'd use like a martial art, like a judo or a something, take them to a session of, let's say, judo, because that's what the athlete that I learned this from was elite at. And her physicality, her strength, you know, all of those things are exactly, her toughness are all what you're looking for. So I would look to take them to a session. Now, it's not one session's not going to turn it from zero to 100, but it can become your, I guess, your yardstick. Like you can sort of say, hey, you know, you were thrown on the floor when we went to that session and you were fine, which means you can dive on that loose ball and you'll be fine. And you know, sort of gain that confidence that they can, you know, have those sort of contacts. They can fall and they'll be able to get back up, all those sort of things. So just use the best of what other sports can maybe give us to help teach us that.
Yep. There's a good reference, Adam Ford, who was on the Basketball Immersion Pod, and then obviously he also spoke about the recent coaches conference, and there's a video on YouTube that you can check out. So he took his group to the Cowboys NRL team, and they got involved in that sort of thing, how to hit properly, how to kind of, he calls them ignition drills, so how to kind of fire each other up, you know, play a bit of toughness, how to hit properly, how to take a hit properly. And you can see the video on YouTube. Actually, I'll send you the link, Rob, if you want to throw it in the show notes.
Sounds good.
So that's a place to start. Obviously, disclaimer, you've got to be really careful about what you're doing with your athletes and monitoring and helping them understand what's appropriate in that space, how to hit those, and what's the level. The other thing, because we've had similar, Zoe and I have been talking about for a while around our kind of dip in country toughness. Again, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but it had been such a point of difference in the past, and we've tried to do similar to what Zoe's talking about, and we've tried to also do it with our selections and send the message through our community that this is what we value. And Lockie Harvey was just a perfect example of that. We had an athlete go down with our under 18 state team. We needed a replacement. We obviously had a number of emergencies available to us, but Lockie really just bled, you know, Country Vic, and his tenacity and his defense and his competitiveness and his willingness to sacrifice his body were all things that we knew we needed to have success, that we want our athletes to start becoming kind of back familiar with. And so we selected him, and, you know, he ended up going from, you know, this kind of replacement player to starting in a gold medal game. That was a credit to him. And then we did the same thing with these selections just gone. There was a young man from Western Heights who had a really good trial, was ultra competitive, you know, played his tail off, and he earned himself a spot by playing that way, and we want to reward that. And that was a credit to him and all the other Country Vic athletes, I think men and women, that are really buying into that and trying to add that to their development and to ours.
I think the thing that's really important to note about the Lockie Harvey selection was the player you lost was like 7 foot,
yeah,
right? Like,
yeah,
and
that's right.
And Lockie, anybody that knows him is, you know, pushing 5'10".
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like it was like, oh, just a like for like.
Yeah.
You know, he was genuinely selected. And I don't think I've ever seen an athlete just, like you said, bleed Country Vic more in my life than that kid in that tournament. So, yeah, making sure you value it is huge.
Yeah.
What do I say to my players when we are losing by heaps and they are losing confidence?
Oh, goodness.
So imagine you've rolled into Nathan Cooper Brown's team at Asia Cup and you look down the other end and Coops is in full squat mode. What are you saying to him at halftime?
Well, I mean, I think we've spoken about this a fair bit on the pod before about, you know, trying to change the goalpost, trying to change what a win is, you know, and that's hard. That's hard to do for a whole season. And that's where continuing to ensure that joy is in your sessions and in your game, finding that joy still is really important. The thing about confidence for me is confidence doesn't come from win-loss. Confidence doesn't come from your coach or your parents or anybody else telling you what you've done. For me, confidence comes from doing the work. So, you know, hey, and it's okay to acknowledge that you're having a losing season. I think sometimes we try and steer away from it and hide from it.
People
like,
know.
Yeah, like that's what I mean. Yeah. So, like, they know. So let's not pretend it's anything, you know. But we can then talk about what we're going to get out of this. Hey, by the end of the, let's sit down, let's start a plan. By the end of this season, what are the three things you want to be better at by the end of this season? And we're going to do everything we can to get you there. And, you know, so then it just realigns the focus to something other than winning and losing and stops that confidence debate because, yeah, I think there's too much of an emphasis on confidence coming from, you know, the coach or other people and all that sort of stuff. And I think confidence should come from you and knowing that you've done the work.
So what about mid-game, Coops? Like you are on the bad end of a scoreline at halftime. What are you saying to your players at halftime to sort of build something back up again?
Depends on the level. Yep. If it's a senior team, and obviously I've been in that situation before.
When?
we had done exactly what Zoe had spoken about, where we had really good self-awareness. We knew it was going to be a really hard season with what we were shackled with. So we had created goals that you know, superseded winning and losing. You know, one of them was creating a locker room environment that was joyful and connected and one that we wanted to keep coming back to. And so at that level, it was easy to just come back to those goals and know that, hey, let's go out here, let's play hard, you know, let's play together, let's find some joy in being here and having this experience together, no matter the outcome. So at the end of the game, when we come back in here, we can look each other in the eye and be like, hey, you know, we tried our hardest, we had fun, and then we'll move on to what's next. You know, when it's younger and, you know, maybe a little bit more fragile in terms of mindset. Yeah, now we're getting back to exactly what Zoe's talking about. Okay, let's find some really, really specific, you know, measurable, achievable goals that we can get out of this thing around, you know, and you can start off really, really small. You know, start off really, really small. You know, let's get a stop in the first five possessions. You know, like you'd like to think that that's probably something you're going to get. You get that stop, you go nuts on the bench. Like you've just won the championship. Yeah, you may look like a bit of a, a bit of a doofus, but I tell you what, the kids would get all, you know, right behind you. They'd love it. And then obviously, you know, maybe the next time out, hey, let's try and get two stops and so on. So I think, yeah, like move the goalposts, you know, find some little victories that you can celebrate. Take that overall win-loss ghoul out of there and just get really, really small, get really, really measurable, get really, really excited and get out of there and look to fight another day.
And I think part of it too is work or talk about what to do, not what has gone wrong.
Mm. Mm.
And I think like a lot of the times the players are acutely aware of what has gone wrong. They don't need to be reminded of that. Focus more on, hey, if we try and do A, B, and C, maybe we'll get a better outcome than, you know, D, E, and F, which is what we've got, you know, those types of things.
That's such a great point. Like, I love that. Like, wiping the slate clean, you know what I mean? Like, just remove that whole first half. Like, do we really need to talk about it at all? One of the things that we did in Asia was I spoke to our physio and doctor, Toby and Matt, who were just absolutely outstanding. I just said to those guys, hey, look, as part of our halftime protocol, can you please basically hustle into the locker room with the guys? I'll grab a drink bottle, grab their towel, and they're going to sprint through. And when they first get in there, can you take them through some breathing exercises? So I think what we ended up doing was just three big deep breaths, and that was our reset point. And so to allow them that time just to sit in there, be quiet, to take three really deep cleansing breaths, and then to kind of open their eyes and reset, the players loved it. They were really big fans of it. They said it helped them. And I think that's a great way to kind of connect both of kind of to come back what you were talking about is, you know, take three deep breaths, flush the first half, what's in front of us, and let's go attack that.
All right, last question. Because bearing in mind, these are the 10 most commonly asked questions at coaching courses. These usually happen straight after the session. You've asked, hey, has anyone got any questions? Nobody said anything. And it's like, hey, I'll stick around for 10, 15 afterwards. 45 minutes later, you're still sitting there talking, which is actually a lot of fun. So don't get me wrong. I'm not bagging on anyone for that. It's actually the best part of it. But one of the questions I get every single time, I have no idea. I signed my kid up to play and somehow I'm the coach. What the hell do I do? Coops, what the hell do they do?
Be the annoying person that asks too many questions. That's what your director of coaching is for. That's what the Basketball Victoria coach development manager is for. That is
No, it's okay. It is accurate. It is accurate. I'm sure it's in my position description somewhere. Right under podcast, I think.
It's what the people in your basketball community that you admire are for. We're starting to do a better job of sharing information and supporting each other and trying to get rid of the tall poppy syndrome. I learned my new favorite word I learned the other day.
Christ-tunity.
No, Barney. It was so I think most people are familiar with Schadenfreude, the German word for basically the enjoyment of the suffering of others. And its antonym is Mitfreude, which is the joy in the success or good fortune of others. And I just absolutely loved hearing that, on the back of our society and so much Schadenfreude. But I think we're doing a better job of Mitfreude now. And I think that more people are inclined to help you. More people want to help you than you think they do. And so having a growth mindset, being comfortable in the fact that you don't know what you don't know, and go and ask questions and go and get on YouTube and go and type into Google, all the questions that you have. I'm sure there's some AI out floating around out there that's probably willing to help you as well.
Like if you punch into like ChatGPT, like design me a training session plan for like under 10 board, it will spit you out something that's not awful.
Yeah.
Like it's, could do some tweaking as most things AI can, but it's pretty good.
It's a place to start, right? Yeah, you know what I mean? Especially for someone who asks that question that's feeling pretty overwhelmed and kind of thrown in the deep end, which is always tough, and we're incredibly sympathetic and empathetic. So, just be that person and embrace the people around, because we are definitely here to help you.
Yep. Sorry?
The first thing, because I've had this exact question at most coaching courses that I've presented, the first thing I do is congratulate them on being in the course in the first place.
Awesome.
Because that's a sign that they are trying to get better and they are self-aware and, and even coming up afterwards and, so for me that's about creating that environment of it's okay to ask questions and be that, as Coop said, that sort of annoying person that does ask a lot of questions. But I think the biggest thing you can do, get to people's practice, just watch what they're doing. Like we talk about it all the time. The best coaches are really just the best thieves. Like they've stolen so much stuff from so many people and, that's how it gets shared. So go and watch as many sessions as you can. If you can't get there, there's access online and things like that. Reach out to people. If your club has a director of coaching, they should be able to help you out. If they don't, then there will be, like, because I know there's a lot of country associations in particular that don't have directors of coaching, but they do have that stalwart, person that's been there, that's the backbone of the place for the last 40 years. They can just help you out and throw you a bone and at least get you on your way until you get to the next sort of place. But, one of the worst things you can – it's not one of the worst things you can do is if you're really worried about it, play 3-on-3. Play 3-on-3 in your practice and let them go a little bit, even if it's for 10 minutes. There's 10 minutes of your session done. I start every session with 3-on-3, free play. The only rules are no on balls, no dribble handoffs. And the reason for that is, one, to get them juiced and up and about for the session. Two, to put pressure on to make sure that they warm up properly. But three, it just engages them and it gets them ready and, that's not having to wait till the end for a game. Where it sets the tone that, hey, we're here to play and whatever drill we are in or activity we are in, this is the level that we want to play it. But it also, we talk a lot about kids not playing pickup anymore and all the things, the advantages and the things that you learn in that. So throwing that in just allows them that creativity and that space and all those sort of things. So that's not the worst thing you can do. And but I would just, encourage, ask as many questions as you can, get to as many courses as you can or clinics or education sessions. Of course, listen to Talking Split.
I was going to jump in
That's where all the answers are.
There's over 100 episodes of content. Not all of them great, but there is over 100 episodes all the same.
It's okay, listeners. Rob will edit this so that Talking Split
is first. there is plenty of content out there. And if you are having trouble getting to sessions or you don't feel comfortable asking a coach if you can go and watch one of their sessions, reach out to us. We'll help you out.
Absolutely.
If we don't know the coach, we'll know someone who does and we'll be able to connect you with them.
Yeah, without a doubt. And that, I think that is genuinely the biggest thing. And both of you hit on it, ask. Like, there's so many coaches get to the end of a season, say, I'm not doing that again. Like, that was hard work. And they walk out and it's like, I've got no support, I've got no help. It's like, well, okay. Ideally, you'd have someone on speed dial. But if you don't ask, you don't get. And it is one of those things where you ask for help, ask for specific help. Hey, I need help with this to get that. There are people out there that can help. And if it's shoot one of us an email or hit us up on Twitter, those types of things, more than happy to respond on those as well. So I think it is an important part. But if I was Letterman, I'll be throwing a card here. That is the top 10 asked questions coming out of coaching courses. I've got nothing punny at the end of it, unfortunately, to load in.
Smash a window.
Smash a window. I'll throw to Paul Schaefer and the CBS, PBS Orchestra, whichever one it is. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. And we will catch you next week on the Talking Split podcast. Look, tune in.